Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I thought we would start with talking about something I heard about on the news driving here. I have been in Chicago, so I got up at about 4:45 this morning to get back to do this program. Happy to be here. But it was a bit of a journey. While I was journeying, I heard about, oh my God, a new antidepressant. Do I hear angels singing? And this is a new agent called Spravato, kind of like Bravado. They must have focus groups for these names. It's actually esketamine. Ketamine, or Special K, has been a street drug for a while, but in the last couple of years, physicians have started using it for depression, treatment-resistant depression, and there have been some rather startling reports. So some bright boys at, and probably bright girls, not to be sexist, at a pharmaceutical company, Lilly to be exact, decided that they were going to roll with that and make a new molecule. So they took ketamine and they put an S on it. I'm not quite sure what the ES did, but it changed its structure and made it patentable. And it's not injectable, although it could be injected. Instead, it's designed as a nasal spray, which is kind of interesting when you consider when we'll get to the side effects. But let's start about, well, why do we need this? There's 25 million cases of depression in the United States, some of them treated successfully and some of them not. There are also a lot of suicides. 50% of suicides are in people who are depressed. Surprised it's that low, actually. And the rate of suicide is 13 per 10,000. So let me tell you, if we had a disease that was killing 13 out of every 10,000 Americas, we'd be declaring an epidemic, a war on it. AIDS never got anywhere near that. Maybe tuberculosis in the 19th century, but we're talking about a very, very serious death rate here. It's up 25% from 1999. Explanations for that probably have something to do with the opioid epidemic. Maybe something to do with the aging of the population, men over 50 being the people most likely to, when you get past your teen years anyway. And of that 25 million depressed people, there are 5 million people with treatment-resistant depression, which means, gall darn it, they just don't get better when we give them our drugs. So here we are, Spravato, S-ketamine. And it's a pretty interesting drug. First of all, it tends to raise blood pressure, and we're not just talking little elevations in blood pressure. We're talking about some serious numbers here. So the numbers I found in the FDA package insert, basically they set you up, you go into the doctor's office, they take your blood pressure. If it's over 140, over 90, they cancel your appointment or think real long and hard about canceling your appointment, but they're still allowed to give it. The rise in blood pressure from Spravato can be as much as, and hold on to your hats, but folks, this is big, 40 points systolic and 25 points diastolic. So if your blood pressure is, 100 over 50, it could go up to, 140 over 75, which is still normal. But if you start out a bit higher than that, well, it could get into the danger range. And this isn't just a one-time thing. This is every time you'd give the drug. So basically, when you go for the drug, it isn't dispensed to you. You have to get it in a doctor's office, and they basically have to check your blood pressure before, check your blood pressure 30 minutes into the dose, check it again at 90 minutes because that's when the drug level peaks, and that's presumably when you'll have your highest blood pressure, and then wait at least 2 hours before they let you go home. This drug also has substantial side effects. 61 to 75% of people developed dissociative or perceptual changes, kind of along the lines of hallucinogens, dissociation, losing track of time and space, depersonalization, feeling like you're not entirely there. even some illusions, like that's a man sitting in the chair over there next to me. Actually, it's a coat with a hat on top, you know, that kind of thing. Not frank hallucinations, but some pretty serious stuff. And a real impairment in your ability to drive. So you're not supposed to drive for at least 4 hours after taking the stuff. Wow. After all of that, who would take this? Well, it only has to be taken once a week. So that's helpful. And after the first, after the initiation series, which I think is a month, although I'm not entirely sure, then it goes to every other week. And it's supposedly quite effective, at least in the 2,000 people they studied. Now, this drug got approved after 2,000 people took it. And these are where the statistics on the side effects come from. One guy was sedated for over 12 hours, so he didn't come back. Well, that was out of 2,000 people. So if you do the math and figure that we got 5 million people who might take it, one out of 2,000. That's a lot of sedated people. That's a lot of potential for other side effects. And they've got warnings. You know, if you have an aneurysm anywhere in your body, probably shouldn't take this. Of course, if you don't know if you've had an aneurysm, you might find out the wrong way. In terms of how long has this been looked at, this new drug? Well, they checked about 400 people for 6 months, and so far they've checked 178 for a year. And this is a drug that's contended for long-term, biweekly or monthly use. So I'm just asking, do you want to be the first on your block to try Spravato? Personally, I think I'd rather have electroconvulsive shock therapy at this point until a little bit more of a track record comes up. So now we're going to talk about what I did this last weekend. I went to Chicago for the Institute for Functional Medicine conference, and I was teaching there, not up there on the stand. I was a physician. I was like a teaching assistant working with other MDs, trying to get their minds around this concept of systems-related biology, what we like to call root cause medicine. So think about it this way. If you see the leaves on a plant dying, and you're a gardener, a good one, you don't just pull a leaf off and go look at it under a microscope. You also might take a soil sample around the roots and see if there's a nutrient deficiency or something like a parasite or maybe a mole or a gopher eating the roots. I mean, this can, when the plant looks sick, you have to look at the roots. And that, unfortunately, is not taught in medical schools. Although we all have the knowledge base, we don't have the structure or what we call a heuristic. So what we teach is a new way of thinking about medicine. So let me give you an example. You know the old thing, calories count? Well, a calorie is a mirage when we talk about physiology. What a calorie is defined at, when we say calories, we're actually talking kilocalories. In physics, a calorie is the amount of energy needed to raise the temperature of a gram of water, that's a milliliter of water, by 1 Kelvin, which is the same as 1 degree centigrade. And so it's like, well, fat calories, protein calories, if you put them in a calorimeter, they all yield numbers, like protein yields a 4 and fat yields an 11, but the problem is that the body is not a calorimeter, and it doesn't burn calories or it doesn't burn food like a log of wood. It burns food in very sophisticated ways, completely different than what we're talking about here. Yet we're still stuck with this looking at the calorie count. Now, how is it that people can go on a ketogenic diet and consume 3,000 calories of fat, and yet they lose weight? Well, that's because a calorie is for a calorimeter, and a gram of fat is in the human body. Completely, completely different situation. So now let's go and see if we can get Anna in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anna. Are you there?
Yes, beautiful. Hi. Thank you. Frozen shoulder.
Okay. Well, first,
How long have you had it?
Oh, I think in between 6 months and a year, maybe 9 months and a year, okay. Something like that.
All right. You want
around
the,
there.
You want the good news or the bad news?
The acupuncture news, because I'm seeing an acupuncturist. I had physical therapy with no results. Actually, I think it made it worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw my acupuncturist once last week, and I'm seeing her again. But I know a bunch of years ago I had an elbow problem on the other arm, and this acupuncturist made it worse and twisted it around. And then maybe a month or two after I stopped seeing her, I heard you talk and give direct acupuncture, electric acupuncture points, which she never did what you told, but I
right.
wasn't seeing her anymore.
Right.
So I'm just wondering.
Okay. Well, let's start with the fact that you could just come and see me for acupuncture if you're local. And if you're not, if you get your acupuncturist may or may not be willing to take advice from an MD, they're kind of trained in to be very hostile and have a kind
I'm on
of.
I'm on bad insurance and they pay for it. So that's where I go.
I got you.
I think she's opened.
All right. Well,
we'll see.
All right. So the thing that you do for a frozen shoulder, first of all, it's not really frozen. It's not adhesions. It's not like scar tissue stuck together. What it is it's chronic muscle spasm. And it's like a reflex loop. You know how when the doctor hits your knee with a hammer and you kick out like that? Well,
right.
If you're relaxed, you kick out anyway. A lot of people are tense and they don't kick very much. But bottom line is that you can, that never goes to your brain, right? It goes from your sensor in the tendon to the spinal cord, and the spinal cord immediately says, oh, that tendon's being stretched too much, I better tighten the muscle. And so it tightens the muscle, and there you are. You kick out. When both sides, both the kick and the extend, get locked in a loop in the spinal column, then they're both tight, and the fact that one is pulling on the other keeps them both firing. And these are deep muscles. So essentially, it's frozen because you can freeze your shoulder on the other side just by tightening up all the muscles in your shoulder. And then if somebody tried to move it, it would hurt.
Okay.
So it's exactly that, except it's no longer voluntary. It's kind of like
right.
when your computer starts, you know, spitting out the same error message over and over and over again, and we need a reboot. So the electroacupuncture reboot essentially involves getting the shoulder really numb using electroanesthesia, which is a very, very high speed, like 300 hertz signal, and you put needles all around, and you essentially get the area numb, and then you have to hit a couple of points, ping, ping, ping with a needle, and then you grab the shoulder and you move it through its range of motion. It's numb. The ping distracts the nervous system. When you move it, you're able to move it way further than you could move it before. Maybe not all the way up, maybe, you know, 135 degrees rather than 180 degrees, but you get a ton more movement than it's had. Because usually when people have a frozen shoulder, they can barely get the thing 45 degrees from their side, if that. And so you get a whole bunch of more range of motion, and then the person just has to keep moving it for the next few days, and the reflex arc gets erased. And
when I would move it for the next few days, it's not numb anymore. So
it's not numb anymore, but
painful?
It won't hurt because you're going to
hurt.
Keep
it.
You keep moving it. It's a matter of stamping out the reflex arc by changing the patterning. There are exercises you learned in physical therapy, like the one where you hold the weight and move your arm back and forth, the so-called pendulum
mm-hmm.
exercise, and the one where
I've
you walk, and the one where you walk your fingers up the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I have people do that like every hour while awake for a day or two after their treatment, if you will. And they keep a lot of movement. They don't. It's not mm-hmm. like a miracle. This is not, you know, this is not faith healing. It is an actual, let's call it we're hoping for complete reprogramming.
Yeah, reprogramming.
You can look up something called the Govecki protocol. That's G-O-V-E-C-K-I. I don't know. I learned that protocol from this lady who's from Canada. She was teaching at an acupuncture conference I went to years ago. And what I just described to you is essentially a variant on what she taught. I believe that there's a video, and there's probably, you could check YouTube and look for electroacupuncture for frozen shoulder and see if anything pops up on a search.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Of course.
Is there a regular acupuncture, non-electric acupuncture way to work with frozen shoulder? And the other question is, are there other treatment modalities that, what would you do if somebody walked into your office other than electroacupuncture?
I don't know of any regular traditional acupuncture procedures for this. So
okay.
I've never been taught any. And since I have this sort of thing that works, this is where I go.
So this is what you do.
This is what I do. Yeah.
Here's what you do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then that answers it.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Good news or bad news? Or you initially started by saying, do you want the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that if you've had a frozen shoulder, well, it's kind of good and it's kind of bad. It's actually the same thing. Typically, if you do absolutely nothing, frozen shoulders resolve at 18 to 24 months on their own.
18 to 24 months.
Right. So you're halfway there.
Huh. Without doing anything.
Yeah. Because they did a study where they gave half the group physical therapy and they gave the other half no physical therapy. And in about 18 months, they were all well.
Oh, interesting.
It just, okay. It resolves. It's not a permanent condition. The other thing you can do if you want to get really aggressive is you can have it opened up under anesthesia. Basically, they put you under and then they move it. And that breaks the reflex arc.
I'll bet it does. different type of trauma.
Yes.
I wasn't diagnosed by my doctor with frozen shoulder. I was diagnosed by the acupuncturist.
Well,
I've had a lot of movements where I'm able to do a lot, but I can't clasp, and I can't reach, things like that.
Well, why don't you go look up rotator cuff impingement syndrome, because maybe that's what you've got. And there's a lot of therapies for that, including, for example, cortisone injections. We've got another caller on the line, dear, so I'm going to go ahead and sign off now. Good luck to you, and you can call back.
So any natural ones? I'll call back later. I'll look at this.
Maybe call. Look that over and look over rotator cuff. You can call back next week.
I'll call back next week. Great.
All right.
Thank you very,
bye-bye.
Very much. Thanks. Bye-bye.
And I believe that we're going to talk to Claire. Hello, Claire.
Good. Thank you. I was interested in the umbilical cord stem cell.
Okay.
Current status. I know that things have grown in the last year. I was told that there's been 40,000 successful cases using the umbilical cord stem cell specifically. I know it's in the news this week because of the AIDS patients that had stem cells taken out of their bone marrow. But in this case, this would be taken from umbilical cords from people that have babies, but without going through the,
bone marrow biopsy. What are we treating, Claire?
In my case, it has to do with my brain, my memory, and my ability to work clearly. I think that this particular person that's offering this stem cell treatment wants to put it up my nose. And when I was listening to the news about the other stem cells, they said, it can kill you. I was going,
all right. So let me start with saying that there's this huge industry, and about a year ago, I was at this conference. I don't usually go to A4M. Actually, it was an anti-aging conference. And when you hear anti-aging medicine, that's where you're going to find all the people who are just doing stem cells or doing umbilical cord, doing Wharton's jelly, which is a kind of goo that's found inside the umbilical cord. These are the people who claim to fix arthritis by injecting umbilical cord stem cells into the knee. And there's science on this that is not as nearly promising as the ads are. And of course, I think it's exactly where weight loss products are. You know, weight loss products, they show the lady before and they show the lady after. Sometimes the photo's a little cheesy and the light's different. Sometimes you can tell she's holding her stomach, and sometimes it really looks like the person lost some weight. And it always says, you know, individual results may vary, and they always give you these, you know, 50% of the people who come to who use our plan lose more than 20 pounds, and all of that stuff is advertising. And a lot of that 20,000 successful stem cell treatments that you're hearing about are advertising. And you have to define successful, and you have to define what kind of stem cells. And when you start breaking it up, by far, the best and most effective stem cells to use, and also the most dangerous, are the pluripotent embryonic stem cells. And the reason that they are so powerful is that they do not yet have, they've not yet been programmed to have a surface antigen. So if I put them in somebody's body, there's no tissue rejection. I don't have to match blood type, let alone tumor markers or the sorts of things that you would use for a transplant. And that's why we got into using adult pluripotent stem cells, because I believe it was George II who did this, but it was one of the Bushes, and he made it illegal to do embryonic stem cells. Except under very limited circumstances. So the researchers went back to the drawing board because, you know, their livelihood depends on getting grants, and they found that they could doctor the stem cells of adults and make them pluripotent, and those are called adult pluripotent stem cells. So personally, if I were going to do treatment, I would use my own adult pluripotent stem cells, pull them out of my bone marrow, process them, turn them into pluripotent cells, and then use them maybe for a neurodegenerative condition. But putting it in the nose is bogus, okay? You can get a chemical into the brain through the nose. But all that's going to happen to those little stem cells that you put in the nostrils, and I mean, show me some data, you know, put some stem cells that are radio labeled in the nose and then pull them out of the spinal column, and I will eat my words. But until somebody shows me that something as big as a stem cell, these things are large as cells go. I mean, they're way big compared to, say, the cells that most of our body parts are made up of. They get smaller as they divide. And so these are big, and you're going to expect this big thing to somehow get through the surface of your nose, which is designed essentially to keep dust and debris and garbage out of the stuff underneath and keep it away from the bloodstream and away from the veins. Yeah, sure. Chemicals, if they're fat soluble, chemicals will get across. And obviously stuff like cocaine has no trouble getting across. So it's not that you can't put things across the nose, but something as big as a stem cell, I'm really super skeptical of that. So I think you've come across a charlatan, and unless he can show for each step in his or her program, this doctor can show, you know, a published peer review paper in not the Medical Journal of Upper Croatia or something. Sorry, Croatia. I shouldn't have said that. Upper Bugovia. Okay, that doesn't exist, so I won't be insulting anyone. But you know, a place where your money can buy you a place in a publication is really what I'm saying. So yeah. A peer-reviewed journal even peer-reviewed journals, you can game it. I mean, the drug companies do that all the time. But for something like this, a well-designed study can show it works or it doesn't work. By the way, let me tell you a scary story, because after all, it's my party. There was this guy who had a stroke, and he was quite well off. I forget his name, but he went to Eastern Europe, and he got embryonic stem cells injected into his spinal column because he figured from the spinal column they would get to the brain, which is true, and then they would be able to kind of magically find their way to his stroke and, you know, regrow the neurons, which is a stretch. So, yeah, he did that, and he you know, didn't work, and he did it somewhere else and it didn't work. He finally went down, I think, to the Dominican Republic, and this time it took. The trouble was, it took in the bottom of the spinal column and turned into a seriously aggressive, completely undifferentiated and untreatable tumor that basically ate the lower part of his spinal column by just replacing it, but it wasn't functional. But it was just like a giant, it was like a giant blastocyst. The very first part of the embryo when you get a ball of cells, you know, that's the blastula. Well, it was a blastula, and it was just a pile of early undifferentiated cells, and they just kept growing and dividing and eating and growing and dividing and eating, but they weren't getting any programming. So they weren't getting the signals from the other tissues telling them what to do. And without training, stem cells just grow. They don't differentiate. So that was a bad idea, and it kind of put me off pluripotent embryonic stem cells, except under very, very special circumstances, like if you could inject it into the area of a damaged heart with a catheter, you know, from the inside, which you can do. Then, yeah, okay, so you're putting it where it's surrounded by heart cells pumping away saying, hey, doesn't this look like fun? Why don't you grow up to be a heart cell? And that actually does work. We've got the proof of concept. In fact, the guy I talked about last week, and you should listen to that show, is using cross-species. He's using pluripotent stem cells from the eight-cell stage in, like, mice, and he'll put them into a rat in whom all of the nerves that would, excuse me, all of the genes that would allow you to grow a heart are removed. So these rats don't ever get born because they can't form a heart because the instructions have been deleted. But if you just drop one mouse cell in there, you get a living rat with a mouse heart because the signals, the language, the programming language, if you will, between mice and rat is close enough that the stem cells actually figure out what to do. And they move in and take over. And other parts of the rat will also have some mouse cells in it. So the liver has some mouse in it and the lungs have some mouse in it. But it was, you know, it's eight to one, except for the heart, where it had free range because it was the only cell that knew how to grow a heart. So he wants to do this with organ transplants, put human stem cells into pigs and take those pluripotent stem cells from an adult human and grow them up a heart in about 6 months. Mm. Not allowed anywhere on the planet. Doesn't mean it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of Wild West out there.
Yeah, it is. Well, thank you very much. I feel very much more informed than I was before this call.
I would like to talk you out of spending your hard-earned money on this.
You have.
Good. That was my goal. And
okay.
you have a good night, and please keep listening. And by the way, read a book, The End of Alzheimer's by Dale Bredesen.
Yes.
And do it. Do everything he says. You know, quit drinking, get good sleep, get the tests done that he suggests, exercise, you know, meditate. It's a whole wellness program, probably also prevents cancer and heart disease. But oh, by the way, he has got good data. It's case studies, but it's people who were like on the edge of going to a nursing home or quitting their job who follow the program and get back to work to what they're doing. So you may be doing something wrong that after reading this book, you can rectify.
Well, one of the things that, as I understand it, is to chelate certain minerals out of my system.
Well, you can chelate a lot of different ways, including just natural measures like saunas, and lots and lots of fiber and body brushing. Lots of sweating is really good. There's natural products that will help grab heavy metals. So natural chelation without drugs is a thing, and you can do it.
Okay. Thank you very much for your help.
You're welcome, Claire. Don't give up. And like I said, read the book and seek out someone who can help you with natural chelation. I think the drugs have their place. I don't like to use IVs when I do chelate people. I'll often use I'll do the natural part and then see if the levels are coming down. And then if they're not, we try adding glutathione into the mix, which is nature's chelator. And often we can make a real difference with stuff that's very safe.
Beautiful.
All right. Hang in
all
there.
All right. Thanks.
You're
thank
welcome.
You very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So let's go to another one of these stories. I learned so much at this conference. I'm just waiting to tell you about all of it. There's a lot of drugs now that go after something called the glucose-like peptide receptor. And what this receptor does is it's an insulin mimetic. So it acts like insulin without having to give people insulin. It causes the release of this, I guess it's glucose-like peptide, that is very effective at lowering blood sugar, which is great for the type 2 diabetics. It works like a charm. I have a patient on Victoza, and it's been, you know, really transformational for him in terms of his blood sugars. And there's a whole bunch of them. There's Byetta, Victoza, Lumexia, Tanzium, Trulicity. Some of these names may be familiar from television, because we all get all our drug education from television anymore. Often that's where I first hear about a new drug, and then I go look it up and I say, oh, okay, that's one of those. And that's definitely the case with these GLP-1 receptor agonists. But you know, wherever you've got a receptor in the body, in the case of GLP-1, it's primarily in the far end of the small intestine, in the ileum, down there near the appendix. And whenever you've got an agent like that, receptor, it's like having a wall socket, okay? Well, where's the plug? If there's a wall socket, there must be a plug. And in the case of this, the GLP receptor releases this insulin mimetic in response to bitter taste. Did you know you had taste buds in your intestines? You do. And it turns out the intestines really like bitter. Now, your tongue, maybe not so much. But bitter is usually something that's got plant alkaloids in it. In other words, vegetables. There's some people who have so many bitter receptors on their tongue, they can't eat vegetables. All vegetables taste really bitter to them, even things like carrots. These unfortunate individuals die about 10 years earlier than everybody else because they don't eat their vegetables. So they get more heart disease and more cancers. So this is just a little aside, but those bitter receptors in your intestine taste the vegetables and actually make you insulin sensitive. So they reduce the chances that you'll be diabetic. Isn't that fascinating? So Dr. Don says, although it wouldn't probably surprise you, eat your vegetables, please. Now, often when I give natural advice, natural medicine advice, I'll hear from my regular medicine colleagues, well, you know, this is not science-based. I only practice science-based medicine. And it always makes me laugh because I ask them at that point if they have any science-based literature that shows that it's safe to use, say, an angiotensin receptor blocker, that's a blood pressure med, and a statin over the long term. I ask them that because there is no data. No one has looked at long-term use, say over 10 years, for a statin and an ARB. In fact, there are no studies that I'm aware of over 5 years. And if someone can find one, please let me see it. In fact, there's almost no science on using any two drugs together. And there's precious little. It's usually short-term, and they're looking at things like elevated liver enzymes and not at long-term effects like on health. What do I mean by that? Well, for example, over 2 years' time, if you're a postmenopausal woman and you're put on a statin, you've got about a 48% chance of developing insulin resistance. In other words, you're on the road to diabetes. Statins plus postmenopausal women don't mix. And when we look at long-term use of statins, we see about a third of people, well, 25% in 2 years, and this is males and females, will get diabetes or prediabetes. And if you're obese in 2 years, it's 38%. Pretty crazy, huh? Okay, this email is from Bevan. And Bevan is writing, I love you and your show. You haven't the faintest idea how much you've affected my life, but you've been a great influence. Anyway, I live up here in the Vancouver, Washington area, where we've had a measles outbreak of upwards of 40 cases now due to low vaccine rates. I have a 21-month-old, and we've been very cautious about vaccinating, particularly with MMR, as I've researched it as having the highest and most severe side effects. As you likely know, the vaccine versus anti-vaccine debate can be very heated. I believe in vaccines, but am weary of the large number of vaccines given early in life as recommended by the CDC. We have a few risk factors, as my family has a history of autoimmune disease and MTHFR mutations. My opinion is that these factors should be taken into account, but aren't discussed in typical pediatric visits when vaccines are discussed and recommended. That said, we've selectively vaccinated, and as soon as the news of the measles outbreak came out, we gave my daughter the MMR. She goes to daycare, and I'm an RN, so exposed in the healthcare setting. The benefit outweighed the risk for both of us. Here's my question. Recently, you discussed the poor reporting standards of medical devices worldwide. I personally know of two cases where patients had severe reactions to MMR and anecdotally several others. Do you think the FDA and other health organizations are truthful in their reporting of the adverse side effects from the MMR vaccine? What is your opinion about our current vaccination schedule as outlined by the CDC? Okay, so first of all, I don't believe that the CDC is in the pocket of industry. I believe that they are honest epidemiologists and dedicated people who are seeking to uphold public health. Now, public health sometimes means that you may endanger one to help the many, or you may accept a certain rate of injury in order to prevent a greater injury. In medicine, this concept is called triage, and it's something we all have to make our peace with, because the interests of the many do outweigh the interest of one. I want to tell you a story. I'll get to your second question later. My mother was a wonderful woman. I won't go into her praises, except to say that when she was a little girl, 3, 4, and 5, she had the nickname Billy. And my grandmother called her Billy because she would climb anything. She'd climb on chairs, tables, bookshelves, trees. She was like a little billy goat, hence the nickname. When my mother was 5, she contracted measles. This is back in the 1920s. And my mother, unfortunately, was the one in 5,000 people that got encephalitis from measles, what they used to call brain fever. So, like meningitis, but in fact, the brain itself is infected by the virus. And this happens about 1 in 5,000 cases of measles. And the effects are devastating. It causes blindness, deafness, other forms of brain damage. In my mother's case, it affected her vestibular system, her sense of balance. It also damaged the vision in one eye. As a result, my mother never learned to drive. She couldn't stand to run or be in a fast-moving vehicle. She was really disabled in the sense that she lived in Los Angeles and couldn't drive. She would get confused with rapid movement. She never enjoyed roller coasters or tilt-a-whirls or any of those things. She sent me on them by myself. And this lovely, vibrant, aggressive child was swatted and damaged by measles. And if you want to, and we can't treat measles. We don't have an antiviral for it. So if your child, your unvaccinated child, is one of the unfortunate ones who gets brain fever, well, you're going to go to the vaccine court, which is the second part of your question. There is money on the table if you get damaged by a vaccine. So, yeah, I think it gets reported. I think it gets looked at. I think a whole lot of stuff that's not proven gets reported as well. But there's actually money that you can get for indemnification for your injury. And I believe that those records are very public and accessible under the Freedom of Information Act, although they may not be sitting on the internet. I think you can probably get them. The data I have from the CBC going back to 1963, this is the last year before vaccination. There are 4 million cases a year of measles. and about 50,000, that's about 1%, end up in the hospital. There are about one in 10,000 deaths, which I find very interesting, because if you get measles now, the death rate is 1 in 1,000. And I think that's probably because way back in 1963, everybody had a little bit of immunity to measles, because it's a very contagious disease. And if you had an older sibling in school, you might not get frank measles, but I think you got a little low-grade version of it, a little low-grade exposure. So I actually think we had a different kind, a more primitive kind of herd immunity back then. And I think the death statistics back me up on this. There's an awful lot of bias out there on the internet, and I always recommend go to the library, look at stuff that actually managed to get published and is in the library. Go look in the inside go look at data from really respected sources. If you read anything on a page that's got an ad, well, you already know that there's conflict of interest, because I'm sorry, but that ad is the reason for the page. One of the things I do to validate pages is I'll take a paragraph or maybe three sentences, and I'll copy that, and then I'll paste it into my browser, and I'll watch how many pages come up that have the same exact three lines of text, because people cut and paste and construct these websites. You know, they exist to exist. They exist to pull eyeballs. They exist to make money. And there are people who are sincere in their belief that vaccines are awful, but I don't believe their science. And I think, particularly with measles, the autism link has been refuted again and again. The reason I don't like to give a lot of vaccines all at once is because of the adjuvants. These are immune stimulators. So if there is a family history of autoimmune disease, you're right on to spread the vaccines out. One a month. You can slow down the vaccine schedule, and there won't be enough adjuvant in there. Feed your kid well. Not so much sugar. Lots of vegetables. Hopefully you're in RN, you're doing that. Give them vegetables. Give them fiber. Give them sauerkraut if you can, or yogurt for sure. Give them some probiotics. Let them get dirty. Feed them root vegetables. All of these things help with the most fundamental protection we have against autoimmune disease, which is a healthy intestinal system. That puts the brake on a lot of the stuff. In fact, an unhealthy immune system is probably a necessary factor for the development of many autoimmune diseases. But I can't prove that. There's a lot of data that suggests that, but that's going to be really hard to prove with a placebo-controlled double-blind study, isn't it? A little short article here. Can mouthwash raise your blood pressure? And this was sent to me by one of my listeners. They sent it to askdrdon.com. And if you want me to comment on something you've read, you can do so as well. This was based on research published in Frontiers of Cellular and Infection Microbiology. It's a pretty good design study. What they did was they took people and gave them a mouthwash with chlorhexidine in it, which is a bacteria killing compound, and they measured their blood pressure. They used 16S RNA gene sequencing to see what happened to the oral bacteria in these individuals. So the researchers for a week used a chlorhexidine mouthwash twice a day, and their blood pressures increased by a substantial amount. So they had, I'm looking for the actual number, statistically significant and about 10 over 5 increase in blood pressure just in a week. That's probably a fairly substantial amount. Small study, small N, needs to be replicated. Why would this happen? Well, it's because of the bacteria in your mouth. Bacteria in your mouth actually convert some of the dietary nitrate. Like if you eat bacon or you eat beets, there's some nitrate in there. and it turns it into nitric oxide, which is a signaling molecule that lowers blood pressure. So it's thought, at least these researchers are suggesting, that this might be the mechanism. Should we be using mouthwash? Well, I never do. If you're unhappy with your breath, start scraping your tongue and flossing, and make sure you don't have heartburn. You could have a dysbiosis in your stomach, and the treatment for that is reduce your stress, because when you, it's all connected, my friends, and when your stress is high, your stomach acid drops, and when your stomach acid drops, bacteria can sprout in your intestine and your stomach, and then every time you belch, the gas that comes up is, well, fermentation products, and it smells pretty nasty. So fix your bacteria first. So we'll go to another email, this from Ron in Pacific Grove. Ron has written before, so I'm going to give you some backstory on him. He has atrial fibrillation, family history of heart attack in his father and brother, but he himself has AFib and A-flutter. He's resisting some of the drugs that his doctors want to put him on, and I certainly don't blame him for that. But he'd like to figure out what he can do and whether or not running. He's a very healthy guy, wants to run in a half marathon, wants to know if it'll increase his risk of atrial fib or atrial flutter. And so, Ron, here's my very simple advice for you. Get your doctor to order a red blood cell magnesium. Turns out people with atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter have normal magnesium in their bloodstream, in their serum. But if you look intracellularly, they have low magnesium. In fact, 97% of people with atrial fibrillation have low intracellular levels of magnesium and normal serum levels. So if your intracellular magnesium is good and you don't push too hard, you can probably do it without throwing yourself into flutter. And that's what I would recommend you do. Give it a shot, but go slow. Take it easy. You know, nowadays when they do those half marathons, there's aid stations standing by with defibrillators. But if you drop into flutter, that's not fibrillation anyway. Don't run it if you're not in shape. I guess that's pretty good advice. And let's talk about ablation, which was your other question. Ablation is a relatively recently invented procedure. And we've been sticking sensors up into the heart for, about 20 years, more than 20 years now, usually going in through the groin. Initially, it was to do a PTCA, that is to say, a stent. Nowadays, we're doing other things. We're going into the heart, and we've got a little burn on there, and we burn the inside of the heart around the place where the blood comes back from the lung. That's apparently where AFib comes from. You burn the area around that pulmonary vein, and guess what? You don't get any atrial flutter anymore. It's a tricky procedure. You don't want to have it done by anyone who hasn't done it a lot, like 50 a year, at least a couple hundred cases. And it's a big deal. There are some risks. It does work most of the time. It's not, but some people, actually many people, have to have a second or a third procedure before it holds. So I think the skill of the practitioner makes a big, big difference. All right, so I have another tip for elevated blood pressure. We were talking about magnesium. That's also extremely good for lowering blood pressure. Most people will get diarrhea if they take too much magnesium, so I recommend starting out slowly and try taking maybe 200 milligrams with each meal. If you have blood pressure problems or constipation problems, that's a good amount to use. Magnesium is also very calming, helps with sleep, helps with all sorts of things, and we really want to get that blood pressure down. There is a very strong link with blood pressure going up naturally as you age. Actually, I was very disappointed. I went to see my doctor the other day, and my blood pressure was over 100, and 112 to be exact. I'm going to have to work on that. More magnesium. The lower the blood pressure, within limits, as long as you're not dizzy when you stand up, and the lower the heartbeat, statistically, the longer you're going to live. So those are things to think about when you're stressing. Oh, one more good bit of advice. I picked this up. It was kind of a joke, but I actually think it's a super good one, is if you're having blood pressure issues, reduce your consumption of news. Turn off Facebook and stay away from Twitter and whatever else you're going to 20 times a day. Just leave the damn thing alone. It's a phone. And your blood pressure will go down. There are also breathing timers. Just slow, deep breaths. Breathe in. Hold it for 5. Breathe out. Hold it for 5. Slow, deep breathing works great for blood pressure reduction. Scientific fact? Changing your diet can also help lower your blood pressure. If you eat 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, that'll lower your blood pressure. If you have 1,000 milligrams of food-based calcium, low fat, please, ideally, but calcium is present in many vegetables. Broccoli has a ton of calcium. Spinach has a lot of iron and calcium. So calcium lowers blood pressure as well. Calcium and magnesium, and maybe a little bit of potassium. And you'll find all of those in, oh my God, is she going to say the V word again? Vegetables. And while we're on V words, vitamin D has been shown to lower blood pressure from 5 to 10 points. So we've been on a bit of a blood pressure thread here, but a lot of the things that we've talked about are also applicable to atrial fibrillation, going back to our friend down in Pacific Grove. We've got just a couple of minutes. I think I'm going to leave you with no one's called in with an answer to the riddle. Let me remind you, the riddle. The family that washes dishes by hand have fewer allergies in the kids than those that use automatic dishwashers. So I'm disappointed, my audience, that no one took a wild guess here. And no, it's not because they're allergic to the soap and the dishwashers. It's actually because the families that hand wash the dishes have, in fact, dirtier dishes. And dirt is actually a really good thing when we're talking about bacteria in the dirt. So they have healthier microbiomes. And the microbiome, as I mentioned, is one of the things that helps keep you from having issues around allergies. This is really allergy time of year, isn't it? And so one of the other little bits of information that I actually have time to give you, because no one got the riddle, is, oh, and by the way, if you have a good science riddle that you'd like me to use, send it to me at askdrdon.com. Let's crowdsource this feature. Okay, so one last little tidbit. Quercetin, which is derived from onion skin, apple skin, lots of vegetables, again, is a strong mast cell inhibitor. In other words, it stabilizes your allergy cell and prevents it from releasing histamine. And histamine is what gives you the stuffy, runny, yucky nose. Histamine in the stomach can cause things like cramping and diarrhea, but that's another conversation. But we all know what it feels like to have a cold. And when you have stuffy nose and sneezing and itchy, watery eyes, well, it's spring in Santa Cruz. And that's why you've got those things. What we'd like to do very much is give us a little treatment. Quercetin, 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams, very safe, equivalent in effectiveness by science studies to the pharmaceutical drug Cromolyn. So how about them apples? Maybe that old adage, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, actually had some kind of connection. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.